Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Goldberg in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up in just a moment, our week in review, and what a week it was. Dramatic developments in federal court from the trial of James Whitey Bulger to the arraignment of Boston Marathon bombing suspect Jahar Tsarnaev. And after 50 years, the mystery of the Boston Strangler, one of the most notorious unsolved criminal cases in Boston history, might finally be solved thanks to DNA testing.
But first, on Beacon Hill today, political wrangling continues over state transportation funding. Governor Deval Patrick has signed next year's budget into law, but he's cut $417 million in local aid and transportation funds. The reason? Governor Patrick wants state lawmakers to add more money for transportation.
So my ask to the legislature is simply this. Plug the hole in the transportation bill. Let's do it now, and we can put that and this budget to rest and get back to the work of growing the economy.
Joining us to talk about the governor's decision and what could follow is Matt Murphy. He's a reporter with State House News Service. Hi, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, the governor's obviously a big supporter of more transportation spending, but why is he vetoing the legislature's version of this bill?
Well, I mean, in this instance, I don't think it comes as any surprise. It's sort of a function of the fact that the state requires a balanced budget. And without resolution on the transportation financing legislation, there's a lack of revenue to support the full spending that was in the budget that the legislature sent him. So that's why he vetoed the $417 million and why he filed a subsequent bill that would automatically restore those cuts if and when the transportation piece gets put into place.
So it's kind of like brinksmanship a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, he said he's never signed an unbalanced budget, and he's not going to start now. Law requires him to sign a budget that is backed up by revenue, and the bottom line is balanced. So he sort of had to do this and take this step today to even that out in hopes of restoring that and resolving the other issues with the transportation and tax bill.
I see. So what do state lawmakers say? Is there any indication that they will go back to the drawing board and try to add another $300 million to the transportation bill in order to meet the governor's request?
Well, what's interesting here is that, you know, the House and the Senate are both prepared next week to reject the governor's amendment to the transportation bill and force him, as he's promised, to veto it. And then presumably, if it gets to that point, they will try to override him, unless some other deal can get worked out in the meantime.
And so what does all this mean for those of us who ride and drive in Massachusetts? Do you have any sense from Transportation Secretary Richard Davey about whether this could mean that tolls or MBTA fares will be going up and will our potholes be getting bigger?
Sure. I mean, the governor's real concern with the transportation bill doesn't kick in until 4 years from now in 2017, when tolls on the Western Turnpike might come down. So whether he wins or the legislature wins with their transportation version, either bill would balance the budget and restore the transportation cuts and the local aid cuts. Now, if for some reason it fails, or the governor can sustain a veto and get the votes in both branches to sustain a veto, the MBTA, for instance, would lose under the governor's vetoes about $115 million, which Secretary Davey said would give them two options, fare increases or service cuts. Now, Secretary Davey said they're not hitting the panic button just yet, and the Patrick administration continues to express hope that they can find a resolution on the transportation issues that are dividing them. That is basically what's at stake here.
Mm-hmm. And let's hope it doesn't come to that. Well, Matt Murphy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Matt Murphy is a reporter for the State House News Service.
And with that, let's jump right into our week in review. Joining us to dive into the top stories of the week are Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. And Dante, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And here in the studio, Nancy Gertner, former federal judge in Massachusetts and now professor at Harvard Law School. Nancy Gertner, great to see you back. Thanks for coming
in. Nice to be here.
So let's start with the news we just heard about the budget standoff between the governor and the legislature over taxes and transportation funding. We just heard about that from Matt Murphy. And Dante, is the effort by the governor to get more funding for transportation going to work? I mean, is he going to be able to get legislators to change their mind, or are we going to be seeing fare increases and bigger potholes?
The background for all of this, this discussion is about additional funding for transportation improvements and to kind of backfill a lot of the transportation neglect that's happened because of the big dig debt that has overshadowed transportation in the state for a long time. And what's happened here is that the governor wanted a much bigger number. Mm-hmm. He had asked for $1 billion in new revenues for transportation alone, and the legislature came out with $500 million transportation plan, and the revenues seem to be a little squishier. So what you're seeing now, I think, is a reflection of the disappointment, perhaps, on the governor's part. There's a lot of confusion on Beacon Hill about why the governor's doing this, because nobody really thinks that his approach is going to prevail.
Mm. What do you hear, Nancy, in the standoff between the governor and the legislator?
I hear a governor who is flexing his muscles, a governor who, you know, isn't going to run again and is determined to do what he thinks is right. So it's an interesting standoff, but I think he's going to hold his own. Whether it's going to succeed is another question.
Yeah, and what's your feeling about that, Dante? Do you think he will succeed?
Most of the people in the legislature seem to think they have the votes to sustain their own plan. They can override his veto. So it seems unlikely. One of the things that's causing such astonishment in the legislature and such exasperation is that precisely because they think that they have the votes to sustain their plan, they don't really understand why it is that he's flexing his muscles in the way that Nancy was saying.
Mm. Well, let's move on to the big story yesterday about the mystery of who was the Boston Strangler. Little background, in the 1960s, of course, a series of 11 murders terrified this region. The victims were all women, most of whom were raped and strangled. Eventually, Albert DeSalvo, who was arrested on a series of unrelated rape charges, confessed to the killings, but he was never charged for the Strangler cases and was later murdered in prison. Now, 50 years later, modern DNA testing could finally confirm that Albert DeSalvo was indeed the Boston Strangler.
Today's development means we may have just solved one of the nation's most notorious serial killings.
So that was Attorney General Martha Coakley. Criminal investigators made a DNA match between semen recovered from Mary Sullivan, the final Strangler victim, and a member of Albert DeSalvo's family. And today, the remains of DeSalvo are being exhumed so that authorities confirm that result. Now, Nancy, I'll start with you. This, of course, has been one of those crime mysteries that have helped, you know, almost define a part of this city's past. What's your reaction to this story?
Well, on the one hand, it says something so remarkable about where crime scene investigation has gone. The story about recovering the tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of material from the Sullivan case is really quite dramatic. I can't say that it is CSI, because I've never seen as much, you know, infrared as on CSI, but but it certainly is extraordinary. On the other hand, there's also something very interesting about the way in which DNA was found on the bottle of one of the family members. You know, we really don't have constitutional protection for the things we abandon now, up until now. But the government can get a whole lot of information from the things we abandon.
Yeah, and we've got a piece of tape about this. So this was, you're talking about how police surreptitiously obtained the DNA sample from a member of DeSalvo's family. Here's Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis describing that.
The only way that we could do that is to follow one of the DeSalvo family members. I assigned Sergeant Brian Albert from our fugitive squad, who's an expert in surveillance, to follow individuals around until one of them discarded a water bottle. That water bottle was tested, and the match came back.
And here's Elaine Sharp, attorney for the DeSalvo family, responding to that.
To surreptitiously get a sample of his DNA is, I think it's outrageous. I think they should have asked us. We offered to cooperate.
Dante, what do you think about this? I mean, was it outrageous? Could they have asked them to cooperate? Should they have?
Well, this being Boston and it's a 50-year-old case, it seems like there's been ample time for bad blood and grievances to develop. And the bad blood here seems to be between law enforcement and the DeSalvo family. It's been reported that the family had said that they would cooperate. Law enforcement has said that they have in the past tried to get cooperation and didn't get the kind of cooperation that they were looking for. So in this case, they seem to want to keep the investigation under wraps until they reached a further point and perhaps out of the grudge that pre-existed, they decided to take this more circuitous route. Mm.
But the circuitous route should give us pause,
yeah.
Right? I mean, on the one hand, the government can go through your garbage when you abandon it. There's nothing actually to bar the government from doing that. DNA is another issue. What the government learns from your DNA is rather substantial. Now, I'm not saying that it was unlawful because it wasn't unlawful given the current law, but we may want to take a look at this and think about these kinds of policies.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, and maybe you just answered the question. Is it absolutely unlawful? I mean, anyone can sort of follow you around and take your DNA and then learn what they want to about it?
Well, it's an interesting question, right? The framework has been those things that you abandon and don't protect,
this case, a water bottle.
That's right. The government can evaluate. Now, we did that when we had low-tech investigations and couldn't learn very much about someone. DNA is a different matter. So DNA does fit into the category, in this case, of something that you abandoned. But, you know, that you're getting much more information from this DNA than you would under ordinary circumstances. So it may be something we ought to look at.
Well, fascinating on many levels. Let's move on to the case of accused Boston Marathoner, marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev, arraigned in federal court this week where he pleaded not guilty to 30 charges, including using weapons of mass destruction in an attack that killed three people, injured more than 260. More than 30 victims of the marathon bombings were there, including Mildred Valverde of Somerville. She was injured at the finish line. She suffered muscle and nerve damage, and yesterday she was walking with a cane. Here she is.
He looked really rough. Like, he had the orange jumpsuit on. His hair wasn't done. He turned and looked at his supporters. He kind of had like a smirk on his face, which, you know, was kind of upsetting.
So the trial is set to begin in late September. The government says it could last 3 to 4 weeks, involve 100 witnesses. Among the big questions, will the government seek the death penalty? And Nancy, we talked to you earlier this week about this case, and what we saw this week was really sort of a set piece as the legal process gets moving. But what stood out to you?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things about this. First, The judge required Tsarnaev to say not guilty numbers of times. There's actually no requirement of that at all. Typically, the lawyer will say, I'll enter a not guilty verdict for my client, or the judge would lean over and say, we will enter not guilty verdicts. The judge had no authority to accept any other plea. This is a magistrate judge, which is not the same thing as one of the regular judges of the court. She didn't have the authority to get a guilty plea. So requiring him to speak, as I said earlier, is theater. Mm. You're really requiring, you want to have a public ceremony, which is not necessary. And so that was troubling to me. The other thing is that if there ever was a case in the galaxy for cameras, this is that case. Mm. And it should say to all of us that this issue should be reexamined, the notion that there actually was a bootleg copy of a video a bootleg copy of one of the videos in the spillover room that was on Russian TV that I saw.
Fascinating.
So this is a case that really requires.
And why? Why does this case make such a case for cameras in the courtroom?
Because it seems to me that it's a case that the public wants to see. This arraignment took place in a small courtroom, a magistrate judge's courtroom. It couldn't possibly accommodate the people who wanted to see it. And it seems to me we have to be concerned about that. I also want to say, and this is related to something else, but the concern about cameras in the courtroom, contributing to bad behavior, the best answer to that is Kevin Weeks.
And the key government witness in the Bulger case,
which
we're going to get to next. But Dante, let me come to you and just sort of get your quick thoughts on the arraignment of Tsarnaev.
Well, first of all, I agree about the paradox of not allowing cameras in the courtroom when you have, in the Bulger trial, you have three people doing sketches, and in each case, there's people tweeting out every single moment of everything that happens. So it seems a little fussy to say that we shouldn't have cameras in the courtroom now. One of the interesting moments that came out in the coverage was that in saying not guilty, some of the wrestling teammates at Cambridge Rinjan Latin of Jahar Tsarnaev were saying that he'd said it in an unusual accent. Now, it's possible to read too much into the way someone pronounces not guilty, but there's actually, in psychology, there's something called communication accommodation theory, which is a fancy way of saying that people adapt the way that they talk to their circumstances, and most of the time people are trying to sound like the people that they're talking to. It's the the classic example of this is an immigrant or the child of immigrant speaking in an American way to Americans and to in a different accent to grandparents from the old country. It can work in the opposite direction too, where someone will speak in a certain way to emphasize a divergence from the people around them or the setting around them. And again, it's possible to read too much into it, but I wonder if some of that might have colored Tsarnaev's response.
Really interesting. Well, in the very same courthouse, just one courtroom away from where Jahar Tsarnaev was being arraigned, the trial of Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger continued this week with dramatic testimony from Kevin Weeks, which, Nancy, you made reference to. Weeks was a Bulger enforcer, a partner in crime, and is now a key government witness after serving 5 years in jail. He described how Bulger shook people down, shot them without remorse, buried the bodies, cleaned up the blood. Here's WBUR's David Boeri describing the reaction in the courtroom.
I mean, they were riveted to this, horrified by the tales. I've never been in a courtroom and seen it get smaller and smaller and smaller as I did this one.
And at one point, and I think this is what you're referring to, Nancy, tempers flared and Weeks and Bulger exchanged some rough language, I think we can safely say on this air. Here's WBUR's David Boeri again describing a moment when Bulger's attorney, J.W. Carney, cross-examines Weeks.
Five people are dead. Five people are dead. Carney came back with, does that bother you at all? Yeah, it bothers me. Carney, how does it bother you? Weeks, because we killed people that were rats, and the two biggest rats were right next to me.
And of course, the two biggest rats he was referring to are Bulger and his associate, Stephen Flemmy. So, Nancy, you're saying this is a good argument why there would be, I mean, the argument that cameras make people act up.
Right.
Camera in this courtroom.
Right. I mean, they had plenty of incentive to act up regardless of what was going on. I mean, high profile cases require different skills as a judge, require different kind of protections. And the cameras, particularly in this day and age, particularly when they are small and inconspicuous, really hardly make a difference.
Mm. Dante, what did you hear in this week's testimony from Kevin Weeks?
It did make you wonder what really the defense strategy is here. You get the feeling that maybe this is a case that shouldn't be identified or shouldn't be analyzed in conventional terms. Normally, you think that the lawyer is doing what they can to get their client acquitted. Here, you know, we're talking about a world, or these are all insights into a world where someone can coolly recount these details of all of these murders and then get all bent out of shape when
someone calls him a rat, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And there's just something, you know, when we're talking in this kind of context, this is not your usual criminal trial. There is maybe a little bit of strategy involved in the sense that these presumably are men, Bulger and Weeks, who knew each other really well. And Bulger's lawyer knows what the weak spots are. Weeks is a dubious character to begin with. If he hadn't been, he wouldn't be there. And by pushing his buttons, by getting him to throw a temper tantrum, which was probably a predictable reaction of the line of questioning, maybe it discredits him a little bit more in the eyes of the jury. I don't know.
Interesting. Well, speaking of Stephen Flemmy, he's going to testify next week. He's the government's star witness. This is Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy, a partner in crime of James Whitey Bulger for many years. His appearance is much anticipated. Dante, what can we expect? What are people looking forward to hearing from him?
In a way, it sounds like it's the same, more of the same in a way. We're hearing finally firsthand details from close associates of Bulger's talking about what it is that they saw and heard him do. And it should probably be riveting, I would expect.
And Nancy, final question to you about this. I mean, as a former federal judge, I'm just wondering sort of what else about these proceedings are striking you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. No one has to justify going to trial. He has a right to have put the government to its proof. What they've essentially done is they've admitted to a whole lot of the extortion, a whole lot of the charges. And those admissions would lead to a conviction of something, and the judge actually could sentence him, even with the murders in mind, even if the jury didn't find it. So you say, what are they doing? Well, a jury trial is a complicated set of moving parts. There is a you-never-know factor. Mm-hmm. There's what there's obviously what Bulger wants his lawyer to do, which is to make certain points that he wasn't a rat and that he didn't kill women. This being his last moment on the stage, he wants to make sure those points are made. And then, as I said, there's a you-never-know factor with a jury. Will they get so disgusted by the government's witnesses that they will do something they otherwise wouldn't ordinarily do? But he's, as I said, he's admitted to so much of this that this is a Hail Mary pass on the one hand and a symbolic trial on the other.
Well, it's fascinating. Let's move on. We've got just enough time for our hubbub, that story that didn't quite make it above the fold this week. Carrie, let me come to you and get your hubbub.
Okay, Anthony. My hubbub is a sad one, actually. I'd like to mark the passing of Daniel Wegner, a Harvard psychology professor who did fascinating work. His really wide-ranging research as a social psychologist included questions like, why is it that when we try to stop thinking about a white bear, we become obsessed with it? Mm. And how is our constant online connectedness affecting our memories? And do we fool ourselves into thinking we have free will when it's really often an illusion? Wegner talked about social psychology as using science to explore human connectedness. And here he is at a conference in his honor, quoting a speech from the classic 1969 music festival Woodstock.
The one major thing you have to remember tonight is that the man next to you is your brother. And you damn well better treat each other that way. Because if you don't, then we blow the whole thing. But we got it right there.
Daniel Wegner was 65, and he died of ALS. He donated his body for neurological research.
Mm. Well, Nancy, let me come to you for your hubbub this week.
Well, I was struck by the interesting parallels between the icon Mandela on the one hand and Mohamed Morsi on the other. What people talk about Mandela did was that after 27 years in prison, at a time when he ought to have been enraged at the people who had put him there, in fact, he assumes the reins of power and reaches out to the minority Afrikaans population. There's story after story of using his legitimacy to bring the government, to bring the people together. Mm. Morsi was just the opposite. Morsi, after having been persecuted by the government, gets into power and doesn't reach, but in fact contracts the government. And it's an interesting story about the difference between leadership and great men in different positions.
Really, really interesting parallel there, or lack of a parallel. Dante Ramos, let me come to you for your hubbub.
Well, Boston's been experimenting with a lot of amenities on wheels lately. There are obviously the food trucks, which are everywhere. And this week, there was also the debut of a city hall on wheels. And this morning's Globe had a story about a third kind, which is a startup called the Fresh Truck. It's a rolling produce market in a former school bus, and the goal is to go to parts of the city where there aren't fresh fruits and vegetables. Now, it's possible that all of the food truck and city hall truck, that this all proves to be a fad, but there's something really great about this fresh truck idea. Because a mobile produce market is a great way to identify where there are unmet needs. It's hard to convince a supermarket to open up a new branch in a neighborhood where it doesn't have one, but it's easy to park a truck.
Mm, it's a great idea. I was really interested in that article. I'm glad you pointed folks to it. So my hubbub is a light one. It's about three great American values: freedom, God, and of course, beer. And it involves the minor controversy over the ad campaign from the Boston Beer Company, which owns Sam Adams Beer. So here's a clip in which you see a bartender pulling a frosty glass of Sam Adams, and then you have to listen to him.
Why name a beer after Samuel Adams? Because Samuel Adams signed the Declaration of Independence. He believed there was a better way to live. All men are created equal. They are endowed with certain unalienable rights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Not to mention beer, but the controversy here has to do with the fact that the Boston Beer Company omitted the reference to God or to the Creator from the Declaration of Independence. The actual text reads, "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." Boston Beer Company omitted that phrase by their Creator, and that prompted all kinds of feedback on Facebook, much of it critical, calling the company everything from abusers of history to engaging in censorship. The Boston Beer Company said it was just following guidelines from its trade group, the Beer Institute, which says beer advertising and marketing materials should not employ religion or religious themes. So even drinking a beer in this age can be a controversial thing. Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And Nancy Gertner, Harvard Law professor and former federal judge in Massachusetts, thank you for coming in. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, new research shows that meditating might make us more compassionate people. I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.